Senior Rector des Insigne Casa de Studios, Dr. Gustavo Cabrera Suarez, Dr. Felix Julio Alfonso Lopez, Vice Rector del Colegio Universitario de Universitario San Jerónimo, queridos estudiantes y profesores, distinguidos invitados, amigos y amigas. Es para mí un honor y un placer estar aquí en Cuba, en el precioso Colegio Universitario San Jerónimo, en el sitio original de la Universidad de La Habana. Quiero agradecer al presidente Raúl Castro y a las autoridades cubanas y a todos ustedes por su calurosa acogida. Permítanme comenzar expresando mis más sentidas condolencias al presidente Castro, su familia y al pueblo de Cuba por el fallecimiento del comandante Fidel Castro. Escucho a Shakespeare convention. It is an honor to be the first president of Ireland in office to visit Cuba. Our two peoples, el pueblo irlandés, muita maheran, in our ancient Celtic language, y el pueblo cubano, muita Cuba, have enjoyed deep bonds of friendship and solidarity over the centuries, and a solidarity which I hope my visit to Cuba will contribute to rekindle and strengthen. Latin America has always been of interest to me, but as patron of the Society for Irish Latin American Studies, CLAS, I'm delighted to have this opportunity today of speaking at a conference that gives evidence of the deep and extensive scholarship that now currently exists on the relations between Ireland, Cuba, and Latin America in general. The fruitful collaborations we've been witnessing in recent years between researchers, between various schools of Irish study all over Latin America, many of which I have visited, between archival institutions, are very much welcome. Indeed, it is so important that we recall and celebrate the manifold historical links that bind our nations together across the Atlantic Ocean, an ocean that unites our scholarship, an awareness of history, of the circumstances which led our ancestors to cross paths along the trails of empire and through their transatlantic networks. That can be a valuable compass as we apply ourselves to crafting our shared responses to contemporary challenges and set about creating new futures together. Such an awareness can unlock for us a rich repertoire of experiences and political means, and importantly, political imaginings of solidarities lived and imagined that do not only illuminate our present, but also open up for us new horizons for cooperation between our countries that call for new solidarities to be forged in new ways and forged at global, regional, and bilateral level. For there is much that unites Ireland and Cuba. Tenemos tanto en común, Irish and Cuban people have in common a proud sense of their national identity, a passion for freedom, as well as, of course, remarkable achievements in the boxing ring. In the past, both of our people have shared an experience of living in La Scura, in the shadow of a powerful neighbor. We are two island nations who've been marked by colonization, and they've had to wrestle their freedom from the grip of empire. This morning I want then to reflect with you briefly upon the meaning of that concept, freedom, at the turn of the 21st century, in a context of profound change, instability, and uncertainty, and challenge not only of a humanitarian kind, but of the most practical kind in relation to our future together, ecologically, economically, culturally, socially. I also want to affirm my belief in the possibilities, the feather of faith, that exist for our people to respond creatively to these changing conditions, these challenges, and our capacity to create new models of development. Reflecting on the wide range of papers that are being presented at this conference, it is obvious that Ireland and Cuba's shared experiences unfolded through the prism of competing empires, particular set of historical events that included repressive laws implemented, for example, against the Irish people on the grounds of religion, and were used as an instrument of economic policy within the colonising project. This history of colonisation and immigration, exile, is the background to the many traces of Irish presence that can be found everywhere in Cuba today, and notably here in Havana. It is also history that has led Irish and Cuban people to forge many bonds of sympathy and imagination, and to exchange stories, dreams, and aspirations of freedom over the generations. We can think, for example, of the great interest that one of the past professors at the University of Havana, the distinguished social anthropologist Fernando Ortiz, took in the face of James J. O'Kelly, the Irish nationalist who in the early 1870s reported on Cuba's War of Independence for the New York Herald. James O'Kelly's chronicles of his perilous journey to Cuba's eastern provinces in search for the camps of the insurgents, to whom he refers by the Criollo term of Mambi, the story of his capture, his court-martial, and his near execution by the Spanish Cuban authorities were followed by an immense international readership at the time. Published in 1874 as Le Tierra del Mambi, James O'Kelly's account made its formal entry into the Cuban canon when it was republished in 1930 with a lengthy foreword biographical introduction by Fernando Ortiz, and then reprinted again in 1968 to mark the centenary of Cuba's 10-year war. It is interesting to note how in that prologue, Fernando Ortiz glosses over James O'Kelly's role as the New York Herald correspondent, and chooses instead to emphasize O'Kelly's identity as an Irishman tied to Cuba through the bonds of a sympathetic nationalism. In doing so, Ortiz situates the Cuban question within a transnational political geography, and he also makes a place for Irish nationalism in the Cuban vernacular, describing the Irishman as a Mambi del separatismo antibritanico. Fernando Ortiz also traces precedents of Irish participation in the Cuban separatist cause, offering examples that range from the abolitionist Richard Robert Madden to the Irish members of the mid-19th century filibustering expeditions of Narciso López. Ortiz's prologue is just but one expression of the fascinating economy of sympathy, as it were, that has linked together Irish and Cuban nationalists throughout the long struggle for freedom in their respective countries. Indeed, at the same time that Irish patriots were challenging the colonial relationship between Ireland and Britain in the early 19th century, an emerging sense of nationhood was taking shape in Spain's American possessions, allowing for multiple transfers of identification between Irish and South American nationalists. And I know that a number of papers, and I congratulate the organisers of this conference, are being presented that will examine the involvement of Irish people and those of Irish descent with a host of uprising and nationalist movements in Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Puerto Rico, and of course Cuba. A striking example of that mutual sympathy simpatico between Irish and Cuban people can be found, of course, in the work of the great José Martí, who devoted a significant number of his New York Chronicles, written between July of 1882 and May 1891, to a socio-anthropological study of the immigrant Irish community there. In those chronicles, José Martí also wrote at length on prominent figures of Irish independence, of the Irish independence movement, such as Daniel O'Connell, who successfully campaigned for the rights of Catholic people in Ireland, Michael Davitt, a prominent Republican, but principally an agrarian agitator of the 19th century, as well as, of course, Charles Stuart Parnell and Jeremiah Jonathan Ross. José Martí's writings also illustrate something very important. I think the different definitions interested him that were being given within nationalism to issues of freedom emancipation, relations between races, gender, and classes. Such mixture of motives within nationalism is something that Irish and Cubans share in their history, as I referred to last night, and it points to contradictions that an adequate historiography cannot avoid. Another particularly compelling instance of transnational identification between Irish and Cuban people was, again, that which I have drawn on, was that studied by the president of SILAS, Dr. Margaret Graney, in her doctoral thesis presented in 2012 under the title Irish Migration to Cuba, 1835-45, Empire, Ethnicity, Free Enslavement. Drawing on Spanish and Cuban archival records, in a brilliant example of the kind of cooperation that can exist between researchers, Margaret Braney related in that work the experience of a group of Irish labourers who were contracted in New York in 1835 and brought to Cuba to lay the tracks of what was to be the first stretch of railroad in Latin America to a sugar plantation. Forced into a brutal work regime under Spanish military rule in Cuba, those Irish railroad workers came to identify with the subaltern position of the bonded labourers from the Canary Islands alongside whom they were working. This led to some of the first welder strikes recorded on the island of Cuba and to the repudiation of the Irish workers by the authorities within months of their arrival. Not sufficiently docile. A few years later, some more Irish workers were imprisoned, accused of conspiring with the phrase used people of colour in what is known as the Escalera slave uprising of 1844. Dr. Braney's work is an important contribution to both Irish and Caribbean historiography, one that enables us to come to terms with the impact of an ideology of empire, the values that drove it, and the human price paid for the transition, for example, from an economy of tobacco to sugar in Cuba. After slavery, of course, the abuses of slavery and the incomes from slavery come to a peak in Cuba after slavery was formally abolished in other parts of the Caribbean. His work of historiography is very important. My wish as patron of SILAS as well is that we will extend into other areas of political economy and politics and all aspects of the scholarly area. According to Dr. Braney, the resistance of Irish workers to coercive labour practices on the Cuban Railroad, as well in turn and in time their identification with the abolitionist cause in Cuba, must be construed not as anything sporadic, but rather as the manifestation of a deeper structural struggle. That struggle emerged at the intersection of the British and Iberian systems of colonial exploitation, and it had its roots both in the creation of a landless proletariat in 19th century Ireland and in the Irish migrants' experience of organized labor in the United States. The story of Irish railway workers in Cuba then shows us that culture and the defense strategies deployed by human imagination can never be entirely quenched by colonization. I think of the wonderful work of James C. Scott on strategies of defense, which effectively turns Gramsci's theory of false consciousness upside down. Tactics and strategies used by peasants in defense within the context of colonization. The memory of those events on the Cuban railroads and of so many other past links of solidarity and friendship between the Irish and the people of Latin America has been kept alive, not just by later generations of revolutionaries, but also in the stories of our writers and poets. Those of you who attended the conference yesterday, thus, I read in the have heard of the Irish connection in the work of Carlos Fuentes and Jorge Luis Borges, and they also heard of the Latin American mother of Molly Bloom, who is given the beautiful name of Lunita Laredo, by her literary creator, James Joyce. It was, in fact, this literary thread between our two parts of the world which determined the timing of my present visit to Cuba. I was delighted to accept the invitation to attend the Havana International Book Fair, celebrating this year the Cuban edition of Star of the Sea by Joseph O'Connor, published by Letras Cubanas under the title El Crimen de Estrella del Mar. I had the pleasure of taking part yesterday in the launch of this captivating book, which records for us the great odyssey of Irish migrants across the Atlantic Ocean, as all the structural contradictions of colonization and the famine and its consequences are floating across the Atlantic. And then all around the Atlantic, there is a debate on the fundamental issue, how might we live in freedom? It would, however, be a misconstruction to portray, I think, those we would have seen yesterday in the exhibition, a brilliant exhibition, to portray all those of Irish ascendancy who reached these shores as women and men who were driven by their forefathers' dreams of liberty and who automatically identified with the downtrodden and the powerless. Sadly, no. While 19th century Irish immigration to the Caribbean was often mediated through the United States and comprised people of lower socioeconomic status, the earlier waves of Irish migrants to this region were numerically smaller and often came through the Catholic courts of Europe and the Irish brigades, four of them in the Spanish army. Thus, in the Cuba of the 19th century, ordinary Irish workers coexisted with a population of Irish Cuban merchants, planters, slaveholders, and high-ranking military men. People who had contributed to building a plantation economy dependent on forced African labor, and who were often committed to both free trade and the formation of a separatist Creole identity. Those people played a part in importing Irish labor to Cuba as part of a project of whitening the population of an island which comprised many black slaves and their descendants. Amongst that older Irish Cuban population, we find families who were firmly placed at the heart of Spanish Cuban aristocracy. Acquiring title was terribly important, such as the O'Donnell and the O'Gavin and the O'Farrell family. This latter family, the O'Farrells, made their fortune as slave and sugar traders, and their imposing palace can be seen today in the Cuban street, only turned into a hotel, Hotel Palacio Farrell, but the best known representative of that class of the Irish colonial elites, perhaps, Alejandro O'Reilly, who grew up in Ireland's County Meath before he was sent by his father at a very tender age to become a cadet in the army of the King of Spain. Known in his time as one of the shrewdest military brains in Spain, Alejandro O'Reilly is remembered on this island as the man who established Cuba's modern fortifications after the Seven Years' War against Britain. The O'Reilly Street, Calle O'Reilly, which is just outside his colegio, is marked by a plaque in three languages, Spanish, English, and Irish Gaelic, with the inscription, "Two island peoples in the same sea of struggle and hope, Cuba and Ireland." I visited in 1987 the Inter-Parliamentary Union, stood outside that particular plaque, and I remember I'm delighted to see Ricardo Alarcón here this evening, who I met on that occasion. The hope which animated Alexander O'Reilly and those like him who spent their lives soldiering abroad was that Ireland would be freed from British rule, perhaps thanks to the military intervention of the Catholic powers of continental Europe. This, of course, was not to materialize. The people of Ireland had to take the struggle for freedom in their own hands, eventually winning the battle for the independence in the 1920s. Donde nos deja todo esto? Where does all this leave us? Why, you may ask, is it important to salvage such a full complexity of the Irish experience on this continent? The first reason, I believe, has to do with our understanding of the notion of freedom. Today, as yesterday, there are huge variations, even contradictions, between different definitions of freedom within the different projects of nationalism. In pre-independence Cuba, for example, there were those who would have been content with Cuba joining the Union as a slave state, like Texas did, so that their system of trade would persist. In Ireland, there was a class of native landowners, not dissimilar to the Creole elite, who were satisfied with the prospect of home rule, that is, limited autonomy within the Union with Britain, and for whom the notion of freedom did not entail any radical egalitarian social transformation upheld by what was indeed a minority within the Irish Republican separatist movement. That egalitarian tradition is a thin, weak, but important light within the Irish nationalist struggle. And what about today? A que nos referimos cuando hablamos de libertad? Is the freedom we most value that freedom from fear and oppression, freedom from the control of human minds and bodies, or is freedom simply defined by the freedom of the market, by the right to unlimited consumption on the island of Cuba, for example, as on that of Ireland, or on that of Ireland? I have been very moved in recent years by the writings of Amartya Sen, Nobel laureate in economics, one of the rare, very progressive views in that form of, modern political economy. But if we share Amartya Sen's moderate and yet substantial definition of freedom as the enhancement of, as he puts it, human capabilities, that is the ability for people to lead lives that they have reason to value, then the question is, what balance should we endeavor to strike in our societies between the mechanism of the free market, perhaps as an instrument of exchange on the one hand, and on the other, regulation, planning, distribution, public service provision by the state to give good health, housing, care, education? There are, moreover, in the Americas as in Europe, those for whom freedom is primarily understood as sovereignty or national freedom in the classical sense. Is it possible to preserve national independence and character while at the same time establishing open relations with the rest of the world and substantial cooperative relations with other states? I personally see no contradiction between a proud national feeling that is important and the ability to engage in regional and international cooperation. I believe too that it is necessary and possible to craft a new universalism for our times. Young people all over the world are asking for this. A model, so are older people who retain their dreams. A model of international cooperation, grounded not in the supremacy of any one model of civilization, but in a respect for the distinctive history and aspirations of each nation, and their deep humanitarian instincts, and in all that which in those aspirations allows for bridges and dialogues to be built with other nations. Indeed, as Jose Martí put it, patria es humanidad, es aquella porción de la humanidad que vemos más cerca y en que nos tocó nacer. The other reason why it is worthwhile, I believe that to reflect back on the history of our shared work together of Irish presence in the Caribbean is because it illuminates a chapter in the history of global capitalism that invites us to assess critically our present condition in relation to current global capital flows. Irish and Cubans operated within transatlantic networks of migration and trade. Yes, that included forced migrants from African and then in turn, sometimes previous to that, of course, indentured labourers from the Canary Islands. The story of the Irish railway workers, described by Dr. Brenner, unfolded at a critical juncture in the transformation of modern capitalism. It was the dawn, as it were, of what is widely described as the first globalisation, a time of formidable commercial expansion before the cataclysm of the First World War that would sweep so many of the young of Europe. That period was marked by a boom, not just in the sugar trade, but also the rubber industry, with its associated cortege of atrocities inflicted upon the indigenous people who were forced to extract the rubber in the tropical forests of Africa and Latin America, turning peoples into slave kingdoms. The abominable practices incurred in the Putumayo region of the Amazon were documented by another Irish revolutionary of the last century, Roger Casement, in what is widely hailed as an early masterpiece of humanitarian reporting. How moved I was to have some of the descendants of those who have survived Putumayo come to see me in Bogota, making a long, long journey in appreciation of Roger Casement, bringing to light, as Roger Casement did, the foundational assumptions and the human consequences of the dominant ideology of the time, consequences which in the past, as today, were presented as natural and an upshot of progress, is essential for our democratic life. It's interesting in Caseman to watch how it happens. He begins in the Congo, and then he moves in Putumayo, and then he says the economic system must declare what its assumptions are, a lesson that is as true today as it was in Caseman's time. The slave trade, that most ugly of breaches to human dignity, has been formally abolished. Yet, our advanced economic system in its distorted, hyper-financialized version is the source of so many other contemporary injustices. Unsustainable forms of trade and investment. Not to mention, what is now agreed has been ecological destruction. Literacy was a powerful tool for emancipation from slavery, a powerful buttress to democracy, to the possibilities of parliaments. Can we nowadays, I suggest, we must ask ourselves, invent a new form of informed literacy, of an economic and fiscal kind, to avoid the drift to a rule of financialized capitalism without democracy, about which I spoke at the University of New York. All of us, I suggest, can with much benefit reflect on the wise words of Eduardo Galeano when he said, "The capitalist system, the so-called market economy, has sacrificed justice in the name of freedom. And the so-called real socialism has sacrificed freedom in the name of justice. Beginning the new millennium, this is the challenge we want We want justice and freedom. Siamese twins living and walking together." Those were Eduardo Galeano's words. But as external pressure on this island is decreasing, and it is welcome, as Cuba is enabled to reopen onto the world at this juncture of a new era, can we imagine new relations between freedom and justice? A problem that we need to solve not just here, but in our world. Can we imagine two new relations between Ireland and Cuba? Relations that would not this time be mediated through any prism of empire, but that would enable the sharing of opportunities and the enhancement of mobility of skills. Can we conceive of an alternative future for cooperation in food, science, nutrition, biotechnology, between our universities, our cities, and our ports, our cultural communities? Can the new port of Marianne, whose draft were made deep enough to accommodate the giant post-Panamax container ships, not become a hub of equitable trade, across whose networks will travel not men in arms or predatory dealers, but merchants and investors, as well as doctors and academics and scientists committed to work for our common human welfare in a sustainable international economy that seeks to secure our planet from destructive climate change? Such vision should not be dismissed as any mere utopia, although there is nothing wrong with that word, utopos, a better place. As I have just suggested, through using Eduardo Galeano's words, now that the collectivized authoritarian state systems of the 20th century, nor the financialized version of global capital that has become hegemonic since the fall of the Berlin Wall at the end of the 80s, are appropriate to our needs. Nor are they adequate for the civilization of sustainable sufficiency that our humanity so urgently needs, where all the demographic trends are telling us where the population of the planet will be, with half of the increase in population between now and 2050 taking place on the continent of Africa, which will by 2050 have 24% of the population of the world. What is to be our model? What is to be our offer for the security and sustainability of people of such continent? We have arrived at a critical juncture in the history of humanity. In no way is the extent of this systemic crisis more striking, perhaps, than its environmental dimension. I spoke at length with President Raoul Castro, and he spoke with passion about these environmental challenges, which here across Cuba are no abstract problem. They are in fact a reality. The speeches of Fidel Castro some years ago to international audiences throughout the decades, were particularly unambiguous in establishing the link between the ecological crisis and the international economic system. The urgency of our position was expressed most powerfully, for example, in his speech at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro, where I heard him speak, and he concluded with these words, "Si se quiere salvar a la humanidad de esa autodestrucción, hay que distribuir mejor las riquezas y tecnologías disponibles en el planeta. Menos lucro y menos despilfarro en unos pocos países para que haya menos pobreza y menos hambre en gran parte de la tierra. No más transferencias del tercer mundo de estilos de vida y hábitos de consumo que arruinan el medio ambiente. Aplíquese un orden económico internacional justo y utilice toda la ciencia necesaria para un desarrollo sostenido sin contaminación. Págase la deuda ecológica y no la deuda externa. Desaparece el hombre y no el hombre." Yes, the current patterns of distorted trade, speculative investment, proliferating inequality, debilitating debt that is producing global poverty, unbridled consumption that is destroying the planet, and destructive extraction of natural resources that are trampling on the rights of indigenous people are unsustainable and immoral. We are at a point of crisis, political, social, cultural, and ecological, that calls for the articulation of new models of coexistence, development, and international cooperation. And the role of scholars and intellectuals is not one of description, which should be one of analysis, forcing the declaration of the assumptions that are behind the models that are failing. The two international agreements signed in 2015, the one on sustainable development in New York and on climate change in Paris, are certainly milestones in that regard, deserve all our support. Yet those agreed frameworks for international cooperation need our help and persistence if they are to capture the imagination, make their way into the public discourse, and crucially, if they are to be effectively translated into regional and national action plans. The extreme volatility and uncertainty, not to say at times, and this is a scholarly point, irrationality, the contradiction, the Weberian nightmare that has been delivered, and the cynicism that currently characterizes too much of political life in too many countries across the world, calls on those who support those similar agreements to be vocal in ensuring that words become deeds and that aspirations become policies. There is so much that remains to be invented. So many forms of cooperation, and it is exciting, opportunities to experiment, so many uncharted avenues to explore for a balanced coexistence between all those human and non-human who dwell together on this vulnerable planet. We now know that there is not just one path to social, cultural, ecological, and economic harmony, no single formula for successful socio-economic development. In Peru, I suggest, for example, that it is not a new suggestion to actually achieve a balance in symmetry between nature and the mountains and social life. It existed thousands of years ago, before the colonization of South America. Ours is not a challenge of imitation. There is nothing to be gained from uncritical imitation of previous practices. It is a time for creating new models, a time for mustering the necessary courage to depart from old and fading models. And the challenge is obviously not the old, but it is of the new having difficulty in being born. And this is the beginning that we must recognize. In his very short and compelling book, one of these engaged economists, Professor Hao-Yun Chang of the University of Cambridge, whom I have met, he entitled his book Kicking Away the Ladder, Development Strategy in Historical Perspective. And he drew our attention to the fact that now developed countries, the now developed countries, did not get where they are through any narrow set of reputedly good policies or good institutions of a single kind. that they are now recommending to all developing countries. Many of those countries, including supposed bastions of liberalism and economic laissez-faire, such as the United States and Britain, in fact, for many decades consolidated their own economic development by using policies and instruments of state intervention, such as infant industry protection or export subsidies that are nowadays frowned upon by many international economic institutions who advocate unrestrained, unregulated free trade. And kicking away the lap is but one study in a rich body of scholarship that convincingly challenges the wisdom of the development recipes that have been prescribed to developing countries. The specific value of Professor Ha-Joon Chang's work lies, in my view, in his historical approach to economics, a concrete and inductive method that contrasts strongly with some currently dominant derivatives of the neoclassical approach based on abstract and deductive methods, adjusting populations to an abstraction that cannot be proved empirically. And also, I think, what we are challenging is a reductive vision of human behavior. Professor Chang's approach has the merit of exposing the highly ideological nature of a dominant economic discourse that often presents itself under the guise of neutrality and objectivity, a covert and dangerous ideological position. No more than there is any one single path to development, recent history also teaches us that there is no singular or simple model of transition to a new free market economy. Indeed, to posit the free market in a special form or a narrow form as the inexorable endpoint for both individual and social happiness. It is to this the planet was supposed to come into existence and its human population move inexorably. Such a notion is to fall into a kind of interpretive linearity that is reminiscent of the worst days of modernization theory. I recall it so well when all of us studying in the United States were invited to look at the backwardness of our society and how we could eliminate this backwardness and become just like our hosts. Or at best, in the interim, we could make our way to a better part in the continuum between backwardness and development. I think that on this subject, and in particular on the dramatic failures of what is commonly referred to as the Washington Consensus, there is abundance that doesn't, a fine scholarship that doesn't need my addition. In one such work, for example, Professor Francisco Peniza, Latin America, Development and Democracy, in fact traces the emergence, implementation and legacy of what was no less than a narrow and dogmatic model described by its main author, economist John Williamson, as the common core wisdom embraced by all serious economists of the time. I think that such an arrogant statement could have qualified you for membership of the Mont Pelerin Academy. Professor Peniza starts his analysis at the time of the demise of Latin America's dictatorial right-wing regimes, widely associated with an ultra-free market agenda. He goes on to show how the failure of the new democratic administration of the 80s to live up to the promises of a better life did bring with it, however, crisis narratives that shifted the terms of the political discourse of the day, enabled the shift from a previous dominant model of policymaking known as import substitution, industrialization, to a model of radical neoliberal reform. Very interestingly, Professor Peniza concluded his book by saying that the blatant failures of this agenda have in turn paved the way for new crisis narratives based on an acknowledgement of the crucial role of the state in steering economic development and a recognition that no development policies are ever right independently or independent of context, culture and history. And we should remember that in the transition from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals, there is a very crucial presence of the state in reducing global poverty. You take the figures, you subtract from it the contribution of Brazil, China, Vietnam, and others, and you ask what is left. Let me offer then one final further observation on a scholarly matter with which many of you, I'm sure, will not agree at all. Yes, it is critical, I believe. I think that it is critical that we not lose the capacity to use abstract models of capital to help us to see how capital in its different and changing forms can still lean on particular settings in different ways and in different periods. I'm really referring to the tendency that exists in some of the scholarship to say that every case is so unique that in an atmosphere of postmodernism, you can in fact actually content yourself with that, as if great period and its moment are over. I side with Yves Chibre's critique when he warns of subaltern studies being in danger of serving as distraction from the necessary critique of capital of which I have been speaking. The work on capital is unfinished work. It is not a project to be abandoned or left aside. Surely the present circumstances show how a universalized capital can cast a shadow over the variety of social forms that are the very substance of such subaltern status. There is in the end no reason to be governed by any unnecessary binary choices between macro and middle-range theories or simply descriptive ethnography. And I do not doubt that a fruitful dialogue will come from conferences like that, will be established between the valuable perspectives as such as Dipesh Chakrabarti and Vivek Chibre, even when leading to reconciliation, at least as the fact. Queridos amigos, all of us are invited to meditate on the tragic consequences of the extreme version of repressive and even oppressive statism which developed as distortion in the 20th century, that age of totalitarianism. Yet we should be wary of avoiding any ideological confusion. Or as we say in English, we must be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. The dramatic failures to which I have referred of the Washington Consensus on this continent, of said these continent of South and Central America, the very continent for which that program of reforms was devised in the first place, and its equally dramatic failure in the other countries where it was applied, has demonstrated by default the fundamental importance of the state in providing basic services, education, healthcare, housing, as well as in planning, steering, and developing socioeconomic development. And Cuba provides an illuminating example in that regard, an example of a state which has proved its ability to consistently deliver such fundamental social goods as education and healthcare, including at times of economic hardship, such as those experienced by your people during the periodo especial. And I do see these certain things of economic, social, and cultural rights as ones that are not threatened by civil and political rights. Today, Cuba stands at a threshold, and it is positioned in a very interesting place. This island has already contradicted the expectations and predictions of so many foreign-based Cubanologists. I was shown by Emily Morris in a series of excellent papers, including one published just last month in the prestigious North American Journal of Foreign Affairs. The Cuban people should not be required to conform to a predefined model of development. They must remain free to shape their own path to development and be allowed to do so, su camino propio. We are facing, may I say again, a world of extreme instability. Old certainties are crumbling. Previous models are shaken. For all the perils inherent in such a volatile world, we can act together, seize upon the real opportunities that exist to create new forms of cooperation, drawing on the capacity of our states to plan for the long term, building on the best of scholarship, but also drawing on our citizens' sense of ethical responsibility, on the great capacity for scientific and technological innovation, and for love too. There is so much that can be achieved by trusting one another, trusting our citizens' creativity, and encouraging the free and open exchange of ideas so as to foster a vibrant culture of innovative, critical, and independent thinking. So may Ireland and Cuba explore together, then, many possible paths for positive social transformation. May we reopen together the question of the alternative development strategies that exist for small countries in a highly interdependent world, and build up our citizens' capacity to respond creatively and with a true solidarity to our changing conditions. That is the ethical globalization, recognizing interdependency that we need to construct. And my hope is that our two countries can make a meaningful contribution to the construction of a multipolar and peaceful world, a world in which the benefits of science and technology are used to serve humanity rather than squandered in armaments industries, now rising again. And that Cuba and Ireland will make this contribution, not just as individual nations, but through their respective structures of regional cooperation. For regional cooperation is indeed an area in which we Irish and Cubans, citizens of Europe, citizens of Latin America, have so much to learn from one another. I am delighted that the relations between the European Union and Cuba are no longer governed by the so-called common position. And I very much welcome the signing last December in Brussels of the first ever bilateral agreement of political dialogue and cooperation between the European Union and the Republic of Cuba. El acuerdo de diálogo político cooperación entre la UE is Cuba. And I welcome the annual consultations that take place in the month of June in Havana and in Brussels on the human rights conditions. I also welcome, like so many heads of state across the world, the progressive warming up of relations between the United States and Cuba that was possible, as President Obama put it, on the 22nd of March 2016 during his historic visit here. Cuba doesn't have to be defined by being against the United States. That statement finds resonance with us Irish, who have understood with the passing of years, but also through the common membership of the European Union since 1973, that Ireland did not have to be defined by being against Britain or anything else. We are enthusiastic Europeans, we are internationalists, interested in ethical cooperation. So the recent agreement signed between Cuba and the United States, those agreements show that mutually beneficial cooperation is possible between former antagonists, former enemies. Those agreements make it easier for your two countries to work together on tracking hurricane, protecting biodiversity, sharing information on pollution, undertaking joint maritime geological exploration. Cuba and its neighbor now work together on a cancer research, a field in which Cuban scientists excel, and on the prevention and cure of infectious diseases, including the devastating Zika epidemic, which Cuba has been combating with outstanding effectiveness. And how well Cuba's reputation internationally has in fact been enhanced by the arrival of doctors and with skill and with proposals in Liberia and Sierra Leone during the Ebola difficulties. Thirdly, finally, most important, perhaps, Latin America's regional institutions bear great potential for articulating alternative development models. I'm thinking, of course, of institutions like the Community of Latin American Caribbean States, La Comunidad de Estados Latinoamericanos y Caribeños, CELAC, but also of the regional development agencies, such as the Inter-American Development Bank, the Economic Commission for Latin America, and the Caribbean, CEPA, both of which have evolved over the last few years towards a strong critique of the narrowness of the approach to development that hasn't worked. And they have also been generating the basis of new models. This move represents for ICAC a welcome return to the generous spirit of its first executive director, Raul Prebisch, who was also the founding secretary general in the mid-1960s of the important but too often marginalized organ of the United Nations, UNCTAD, the Conference on Trade and Development. And as a young man, I remember reading Julius Nyerere's visit to Canada after he had thought there was a possibility of a new international economic order, and coming home, and he wept and he said, "I thought they were serious, but they don't mean it." We do need again to have that form of international cooperation if we are to deliver on those great agreements of 2015. In her acceptance of the doctor's honoris causa she received from the University of Havana last year, the current executive secretary of ICLAC, Alicia Barracena, put it in clear and compelling terms what she saw as the role of her institution in shaping distinctive development paths for its member countries. Laissez-parler es una voz del sur que intenta construir desde nuestra historia, desde nuestra cultura, nuestras insuficiencias y potencialidades, un pensamiento y un camino propio para la construcción de ciertas sociedades más justas. Yes, indeed, made stronger by an awareness of both its limitations and its possibilities, wiser from the experience of both dictatorship and democracy unfinished, and rich of the caring relation to nature that our indigenous people carry, this Latin American space can be the cradle of a new civilization of sufficiency, a civilization grounded in the unique history and aspirations of its constituent peoples. Here, new life might be breathed into the aesthetic yet profoundly ethical vision of José Martí, who after all reminded us that la naturaleza es hermosa, que la vida es un deber, que la muerte no es fiel, que nadie debe estar triste ni acobardarse mientras haya libros en las librerías, y luz en el cielo, y amigos, y madres. Long live the friendship between Ireland and Cuba. Gur fada búna ar gorda sida muinta na heirin agus muinta cúpa. Viva la inista dintu el pueblo irlandés y el pueblo cubano. Muchísimas gracias.